Welcome to Your Call. I'm Eric Jansen, in for Rose Aguilar. Today we'll discuss a number of issues important to elders. Our show's in three sections. In about 15 minutes, we'll speak to an expert on elder abuse about how abuse skyrocketed through the COVID pandemic. We'll discuss a number of factors that led to this trend and what people who care about the health and well-being of seniors can do to spot the warning signs of abuse. Later this hour, we'll speak with an advocate with a cooperative senior community resource center called Ashby Village in the East Bay about the Village Movement and what programs and services these communities provide for older people. First, though, we discuss the rising trend of senior poverty. Over 15 million adults aged 65 and older are economically insecure, with incomes below 2 times the federal poverty line, according to the National Council on Aging. And nearly 1 in 4 people 65 or older make less than 150% of the federal poverty line. For those living alone, that's less than $20,000 a year. The percentage of low-income elders living in or near poverty is even higher for women, people of color, and LGBTQ seniors. What resources are available for these seniors facing economic insecurity, and how will a split Congress affect programs that are vital to their health and well-being, like Medicare and Social Security? Joining us to discuss this is our first guest this hour, Denny Chan. Denny Chan is the managing attorney of Justice and Aging's Equity Advocacy Teams. Justice and Aging is a national nonprofit legal advocacy organization that fights senior poverty through law by securing access to affordable health care, economic security, and the courts for older adults with limited resources. Since 1972, Justice and Aging has primarily focused its efforts on marginalized elderly people, including women, people of color, LGBTQ folks, and those with limited English proficiency. Denny, thank you so much for joining us on Your Call to discuss these important issues.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning, and thank you so much for taking this really important topic and shining a light on it during your show today.
Absolutely. So according to the U.S. Census Bureau, 9.5% of the elderly population was living in poverty in 2020. That figure rose to 10.7% last year. The coronavirus pandemic was a central driver of this uptick. A New York Times feature on the phenomenon details how the pandemic disproportionately caused older workers to leave the labor force, and those workers weren't eligible for as much pandemic relief as families with children. Can you tell us more about the specific pressures that the pandemic put on older adults?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think one of the key pieces of that story and what you just told us about older adults leaving the workforce is oftentimes we don't think about when they come back from the workforce and when they try to come back to the workforce, you know, they face a significant amount of age-based discrimination. And, you know, that's unfortunately rooted in structures in our country that are ageist in nature. Lots of concerns, of course, around the ability of people to come back and work and, people who have ageism or ageist employment practices in their hiring. So there were a number of workers who may have felt, you know, those are the people who felt comfortable during COVID-19 to come back into the workforce, despite the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on health of older adults. Would still face some barriers in coming back to work and getting gainful employment because of age-based discrimination. That's one part of the story. Another piece of the story around COVID-19 and older adults and specifically senior poverty is really, you know, thinking about the disproportionate impacts of COVID-19 on older adults of color, older women, older LGBTQ, older adults, and older immigrants, all these groups who've, of course, faced historical and systemic discrimination. Those are people who were less likely to have significant savings prior to COVID-19, and because of the pressures of COVID, are now even more worse off, unfortunately, in the aggregate.
Denny, can you kind of describe some of the living conditions, what people are having to do to get by?
Yeah, I think it's really quite unfortunate. You know, in our work at Justice and Aging, we work with advocates across the country, across the state, and we hear really heartbreaking stories of people who are faced with really difficult decisions around, deciding between putting food on the table and being able to pay for medical expenses. People who are faced with extreme housing insecurity, especially in this state when housing costs are so expensive, this disproportionately hurts older Black renters. And in many counties in California, the fair market value of a simple, studio exceeds the amount that people would be getting in government benefits programs. So there's a lot of difficult choices that older adults have to make in terms of being on a fixed income. And then, of course, we've seen rising inflation and unfortunately, insufficient sort of maintaining or keeping up with the benefits to be able to continue to afford those basic expenses.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the ways that you and your team at Justice and Aging advocate for seniors? How do you advocate for seniors through the courts and legal systems? How do you use those tools?
Absolutely. So we have a small and growing team of advocates across the country who work with lots of people who work with older adults and people who are legal services attorneys, all of whom, we try through policy and advocacy to end senior poverty. And we know that one of the key pieces in ending senior poverty is having a robust safety net program and safety net programs that lift older adults out of poverty. So for example, we know that Social Security has reduced poverty from 48% to 17.1% among older Black adults 65 and up. And we know that it's also reduced poverty from 45.4% to 16.6% among Latino older adults. These public programs work. They have worked since their inception. A lot of people don't know that Medicare, for example, actually helped integrate our country's hospitals many decades ago. So that's all part of our history, part of the infrastructure, part of the vast network of programs that help, older adults make ends meet. And what we need to do is really continue to maintain those programs, update those programs, and make sure that those programs are sufficiently meeting the needs of older adults, today, tomorrow, and well into the future.
Yeah. Justice and Aging has been around for 50 years. It's worth reminding folks of that. I didn't realize that myself. You have a recent report detailing the ways that poverty amongst the elderly especially affects women, LGBTQ women and women of color, feeling the worst of this. And I'm curious to know from your report, does the report show what the main causes are of this disparity? And also that Black, Hispanic and Native women are almost two times more likely to live in poverty than older white women.
Yeah, I would say, the report, I think, does a really great job, and I encourage your listeners to take an opportunity to read it, because I think it really lays out multiple reasons for that poverty. One of the key reasons, of course, is intersectional discrimination, that is discrimination on the basis of multiple identities, and how that works for older adults is that discrimination has compounded over time, and the impacts of that discrimination has compounded over time. So, for example, if you think of an older Black woman who, as a younger Black woman, was likely paid less than her white male counterparts, that has a present impact as a younger Black woman that she is, in present time getting less. And then it also means that as an older adult, as an older woman, when she retires, she's going to get less because she paid less into the system. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's how our benefit system, our retirement benefit system work in this country. It's a function of how much you put in. And if, unfortunately, you are discriminated against, as we know sort of in an aggregate way exists, that means you'll get not only less, I call it like it's two bites at that same rotten apple. Mm-hmm. One bite, when you're getting the paycheck and when you're working, and then you get less because you put in less. And unfortunately, that's one of the reasons why you put in less is because you were discriminated against.
I'm sorry, just going to say it, especially in traditional marriages where Women are more likely to be doing the at-home things and not making an income, even though they're working just as hard or harder.
Right, right. And so there's ways in which we, as a society and as a country, devalue what's, you know, or have gendered notions of what is considered work and what's considered valuable work, work that is worth being compensated for. And then that, so that's true both, you know, when people may not be working traditional jobs. And then it's also true that, you know, as women are trying to work and get paid, they're paid less than their male counterparts.
Mm-hmm, right.
And so the other thing I was going to say is we also know that women tend to live longer. And some of the other groups that you mentioned that we advocate on behalf of, for example, LGBTQ older adults, also face greater health inequities because of discrimination in the healthcare system. And all those then tend to mean that they have higher healthcare costs. Because of their, you know, worse health outcomes, they end up then being in a place where they have to sometimes have to pay more and have to afford more. And unfortunately, what a lot of people don't realize is that because of racialized health inequities or health disparities, people often think, for example, that Medicare, once you're 65 and up, pays for everything. And unfortunately, that's really an oversimplification of how it works. There's a lot of things that Medicare doesn't cover. So for example, and I can't remember, unfortunately, if this was in our report or not, but we have some other resources detailing how the lack of a coverage of oral health benefit in Medicare disproportionately impacts communities of color who tend to have more oral health needs. And all that's really rooted in a healthcare system that discriminates against older adults of color. Mm-hmm. So we know from another report done by the Commonwealth Fund, that one out of four Black and Latino older adults 60 and older report mistreatment by health professionals because of their race.
Okay.
They're more likely to have worse health outcomes, face economic hardship, and be dissatisfied as a result. So all of those things, when you're asking about what's the root cause, there are really lots of root causes, but it's grounded in a country and an infrastructure and systems that devalue certain people.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to see that report, I just want to let listeners know that Justice and Aging's report, we have a link on our website, klw.org, and go to the Your Call page. I do want to ask, you mentioned Medicare, and I want to ask you a little bit more about this. Medicare and Medicaid, I understand that nearly one-fifth of enrollees were eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, which in California is called Medi-Cal, in 2019. That's the last year that we had data. How do you know Medicare is so complicated? I just turned 65 this year, by the way, and so
congrats.
You know, I've just been dealing with, wow, there's so many, it's so confusing. I feel like I'm pretty well educated, but I have a really hard time understanding this. How many, do you have any sense of how many people just aren't taking advantage of the Medicare programs that they could be?
As you said, it's really complicated. So it would depend on, there's a lot of specific types of programs and benefits that can help Medicare beneficiaries and Medicaid beneficiaries pay for healthcare costs that don't get you, that are underutilized or rather under-enrolled. And we know that. I don't have specific numbers for you, but I can tell you that, you know, there are a lot of reasons why that's the case. For these benefits programs, many of them are not automatic. You know, you have to sign up or you have to affirmatively put in an application. And we think about the people who we've been talking about during our interview. We are thinking about women, people of color, LGBTQ older adults, older immigrants, people who are just tend to be less connected to systems and structures. It's going to be harder for them to put in the application because a lot of times people don't know, or, you know, as you're hinting at, it's super confusing to even figure out how to apply for a lot of things. And then we also, I think, are still grappling with the impacts of a previous federal administration that scared many people away from using benefits, especially older immigrants.
Mm-hmm. I know we have a lot to cover. We have to move on to our expert who's going to talk about elder abuse. But I wanted to ask you how you see a split Congress with Republicans taking control of the House by a slim margin. How do you see that affecting the future of Medicare and Social Security, too?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll see how it shapes out. I mean, my sense is that Republicans will try to cut spending on these public programs that we know, when spending more on, lifts people out of poverty. You know, we know that they don't have complete control over Congress, so we'll see where that goes. And I think we still have some opportunities working with this federal administration and President Biden to move the needle on some of these programs.
I want to take a caller from a listener. Let's hear from Mary in San Francisco. Mary, welcome to your call. Mary, are you there? I'm not hearing you. There we go.
Hello.
Mary, are you there? Thank you.
Yes. Hello?
Yes. Hi. You're on the air.
Okay. You're hearing me. Good. And
yes.
I'm in my 70s. I'm on Social Security, Medicare, Medi-Cal. And I want to specify how the gender pay gap follows a woman into retirement. I can use myself as a specific example. Because I started working in the 1960s, and the fact that men have been paid more, I think a woman gets 80 cents to every dollar, and it, of course, varies. And because of Social Security being calibrated on its payroll tax, so 6.7% altogether, what happens is now I'm basically getting 80% of Social Security of my male counterpart. So, and here are some things that can be done to help seniors on Social Security below the poverty line. One is abolish the Medicare Part B premium. I don't pay it because I'm on a program for low-income people on Medi-Cal to pay my Medicare Part B premium, but I have to reapply every year. Another thing is student loan debt. I'm on a program where I don't pay student loan debt, but I have to reapply every year. So we're submerged in paperwork, utilities, insecurity, and food. No senior should have to pay full price for food or utilities. There should be vibrant discounts in these things. And so thank you very much. There's so much more. And LGBTQ couples get benefits through Social Security, spouses and survivors. So marriage equality is vitally, vitally important.
Thank you so much for that call, Mary. One brief little note about that. I found out that, according to the federal government, because I'm in this situation, my partner and I are domestic partner registered, but we're not married, so we don't have the same there's some discrepancies in how we are treated by Social Security and by Medicare, so be careful for that. And the Part B thing yeah, don't miss out on getting it when you can, or you may be penalized for quite some time. Denny, we need to move on, but I do want to ask you first before we move on, how does one get connected with Justice and Aging for help if they need help or to become an advocate?
Sure. I would recommend that you visit our website, www.justiceandaging.org, where you can sign up for our alerts and learn more about the work that we do.
Thank you so much for sharing that important information. Denny Chan is the managing attorney of Justice and Aging's Equity Advocacy Team, and we will have that link on our page on on kalw.org. Go to the Your Call page. A small content warning for our listeners now. We're now turning to a discussion about the growing trend of abuse against elderly people. If this is a topic that's sensitive to you or other folks where you are listening, please note that we'll be on this topic for about 20 minutes. If you have experiences with elder abuse you'd like to share or questions for our expert, we'd love to hear from you over the phone. Our phone number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email us if you prefer, yourcall@kalw.org. Our expert guest for this topic is Dr. Laura Mosqueda. She's a professor of family medicine and geriatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at USC, University of Southern California, and the director of the National Center on Elder Abuse, a federally funded initiative that serves as the nation's coordinated body for research, training, best practices, news, and resources on the subject. Dr. Mosqueda also serves as a fellow in the Health and Aging Policy Fellowship Program and is the principal principal investigator of a National Institute on Aging-funded study to understand the causes of abuse of people with dementia and the leader in the elder justice field. Dr. Mosqueda, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, particularly following this great group, Justice and Aging, who does tremendous work.
Yeah. We saw a giant surge in the number of elder abuse cases during the pandemic. A study by Yale University released in January of 2021 found that more than one in five older people living in homes or apartments, as opposed to in facilities, reported abuse in April and May of 2020 when states had stay-at-home orders. That's an increase over pre-pandemic estimates of more than 83%. So, Dr. Mosqueda, what do you think? What factors led to this huge jump in abuse during the pandemic?
Well, there are a number of factors that led to that. The other thing I just want to caution folks about is how accurate all of our data are on elder abuse and neglect. And if you'd like, we can talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But clearly, when people were having to spend more time in close quarters and so many things were shut down, like adult daycare programs that really serve older adults who have demanding illnesses like Alzheimer's disease, and now they're in families, sometimes quite chaotic homes, et cetera. We know that about 50% of people with a demanding illness will be abused or neglected at some point. And you can imagine that the odds increase when everybody's in close quarters and close proximity.
And yes, and before, and we've seen all kinds of domestic violence increase, and you know, road rage, and shootings. People are under taking their pressure about the COVID pandemic in very horrifying ways. But before we go further, let's define what we mean by elder abuse, or what your area of expertise in this field includes. Do we mean primarily physical abuse, or does it also include psychological and emotional abuse, and for that matter, financial abuse, convincing or manipulating older people to give up their money or give up control of their money?
Yeah, all of the above. You know, unfortunately, there's lots of ways that older adults can be abused and neglected. It, as you said, it includes financial abuse, which is one of the most common forms. It also includes physical abuse, sexual abuse, which we often don't talk about, and emotional or psychological abuse. One particularly rough story that comes to mind is a woman who told me that her daughter implied threats by removing the heads of her prized doll collection in front of her.
Wow.
Now, there was no physical abuse going on there, right? She wasn't denying her food, water, etc. But you can imagine the emotional impact of something like that. So sometimes we minimize emotional abuse, yet it's a horrible issue that goes on as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's neglect. And this is when people are not provided by basic services from the people who are supposed to be, who have what sometimes is called their care and custody. So people who are expected to provide this, maybe through contractual or familial relationships, stop or just don't provide that.
So that's kind of a passive abuse, neglect.
Yes, you know, it is a passive in that it is the lack of doing something, yet it is what leads to things like pressure sores, malnutrition, et cetera.
So I guess that makes sense then why family members are committing elder abuse in nearly 6 out of 10 cases, according to the National Council on Aging. Can you say anything more about, I don't know, family dynamics and how this is a symptom of family dysfunction?
Yes, it often is a symptom of family dysfunction. And I need to always be careful when I talk about this because I'm in no way excusing abusive acts. But I do think it's important for us to understand what is motivating the person who is doing the abuse or the neglect. Because my big hope is that we can prevent a lot of this. So, for example, when it comes to financial abuse, it's not uncommon if somebody has, say, 4 children that they know maybe that there's one who's, let's just say, more questionable or has their ethics aren't quite on board with societal ethics. And this person can then protect themselves through writing a trust, will, et cetera, knowing that this might be happening in their future. So there's a lot we can do to protect ourselves. The other thing is that when it comes to things like physical abuse or emotional abuse, sometimes an older adult who requires care, and let's remember, most older adults don't require care. They're perfectly fine and doing really well. But for those who do require care due to physical and or cognitive frailty, sometimes the family member who's chosen to provide this care is the one who perhaps hasn't worked in a long time, and perhaps they haven't worked in a long time because they have an untreated mental health problem. And you can see how this all sorts of builds can build up to situations that create and enhance conflict.
We need to take a very short break here. We'll be back in just 1 minute. I want to encourage listeners that if you have anything to contribute to this conversation, please give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Welcome back to Your Call. I'm Eric Jansen speaking with Dr. Laura Mosqueda, who is a professor of family medicine and geriatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at USC and the director of the National Center on Elder Abuse. So, Dr. Mosqueda, I want to ask you about a couple of the things here. According to a recent feature in the Wall Street Journal, elder abuse cases are expected to continue rising in part due to the lack of trained and licensed caregivers, which leaves them vulnerable to living with abusers. Can you speak a little bit to why there's such a shortage of qualified caregivers?
Yes, unfortunately, well, there's a variety of reasons for it. One, very underpaid group of people. Whether you're talking about people who work at nursing homes doing very difficult work, or whether you're talking about people who are doing home care. So that's a big problem. And we, you know, have issues, as folks like Justice and Aging know, related to the immigration issues for people who are willing to provide care for older adults, and language barriers, et cetera. The other thing that goes on is that people can't afford to pay for this. So you may have a family member who recognizes that they need help, but they simply can't afford it. And this brings up issues like the lack of long-term care insurance or the difficulty of getting that. So we also have the fastest growing segment of our population in the United States, people over the age of 85. So you have these bad trends intersecting, this exponential growth of the people who are very elderly in our society, who are more likely to require care, and not enough caregivers. And so these are colliding now and creating huge problems.
Mm-hmm. We also know that there was a disproportionately high number of deaths for people in long-term care facilities during the pandemic. And this led a lot of people to pull their elder loved ones out of those facilities to be cared for at home by family members or in-home caregivers. And you've already talked about the shortage of qualified caregivers. How has that affected the trends that we're seeing?
Yeah, well, so, you know, there can be abuse and neglect in long-term care facilities as well as at home. People often assume, well, it only happens in nursing homes. But as you pointed out earlier, the majority of abuse and neglect is occurring in private homes, in the community. So I think people were pulling their loved ones out of love and panic, right? There's no other population that could have been put into essentially solitary confinement for a year other than older adults in nursing homes, which I thought was just a huge tragedy that I hope we learn from and put many families under severe stress.
How can someone outside of the home, someone, you know, an outside friend perhaps, if there's abuse going on, are there signs to look for to you know, wonder if something's going on here? And are there similar kinds of rules as there are for, you know, child abuse, if reporting requirements, for example?
Yes. Anybody can make a report if they have a suspicion of abuse or neglect to Adult Protective Services. And there's an APS in every county in the United States. Almost every state has required reporting laws. So, for example, for me as a physician, I'm required to make a report if I have a reasonable suspicion. And I point out this term reasonable suspicion because we are not, and certainly people in the community as well, we don't have to confirm it and know, gosh, for sure this is going on. If we have a concern, Adult Protective Services is a professional organization of, you know, with people, mostly social workers, who can go out and assess what's going on. And sometimes people are worried, like, I don't want to make a report, get the government involved. But really what they're doing is just going and checking things out. And they're not taking older adults out of their home or ripping families apart. They really go in with a solution-oriented sort of approach of how they can maintain people where they want to be.
Great. Actually, we have a caller who has a question on point about this. Kevin, let's go to Carol in San Francisco.
Hi there.
Hi, Carol.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a friend who's an older adult and is living in an isolated situation, unable to drive, and he's living with an emotionally abusive person, and I wonder if there's any way that he could receive assistance either in traveling to be with other people or have someone come in so that he's not so isolated.
Any suggestions on that, Dr. Masoda?
Yeah, absolutely. And Carol, you're well named because you care, and I really appreciate that. And you're just the kind of friends we need around to recognize these things. So this is a great type of situation to call Adult Protective Services and ask them to come out and take a look at the situation. It might be worse than you think. It might not be as bad as you think, but at least they could come in and get eyes on, and they might then be able to link the friend of yours to a variety of services, including dial a ride kinds of things or whatever. And they might be able to see that the person he's living with who is emotionally abusive, perhaps can receive some sort of treatment that will lessen that.
Carol, any more questions on that?
Oh, I just said I did call Adult Protective Services at one point, and you know, this housemaid is very good at sort of putting on an act. So, you know,
call them again.
Okay.
Call them again, because it can feel really frustrating sometimes. Like, I called and nothing, it feels like nothing happened. But if you see that this is ongoing, I would call them again so that they know that concerns continue.
Yeah, and I would imagine a second call elevates the level of concern on their part, right?
Correct, right.
Carol, thank you very much for that call. One last question for you, Dr. Mosqueda. I'm curious about how, you know, as both a professor of medicine and a doctor, what are ways to make doctors more aware of this issue if you think they are not aware enough of it, and raise awareness generally about the topic for those who practice medicine?
Yeah, so we certainly do it a lot through training and education. We've developed curricula for people who are still in training for medicine, as well as for physicians who are already in practice. We have slide sets so that we can sort of train the trainers and are just continuing to raise awareness at the national level with partnerships, for example, at the American Geriatric Society. But we have a long way to go. Physicians are unfortunately among the worst people to recognize and report abuse and neglect. So we really need to work harder at educating physicians.
Why is that?
Well, you know, when we're seeing an older adult who has a bruise or a fracture, you know, a broken bone or a pressure sore, you can almost always find a reason other than abuse or neglect that they have that.
Mm-hmm.
Because older adults have changes that make us more susceptible to broken bones, et cetera. And so we find that physicians tend to attribute a wound, for example, to these other medical reasons and don't necessarily have the possibility of abuse on what we call your differential diagnosis, your list of reasons that somebody might be coming in with this. With a large movement now for geriatric emergency departments certified in geriatrics, we're hoping that these sorts of things will begin to improve, and that physicians and our partners in providing health, you know, the nurses, physician assistants, et cetera, that will become better at protecting older adults who can't speak up for themselves.
Thank you very much. I want to really thank you for your time this morning. Dr. Laura Mosqueda is a professor of family medicine and geriatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at USC and the director of the National Center on Elder Abuse. Thanks again so much for your time.
Thank you. And I'd encourage people to go to our website, the National Center on Elder Abuse, for information for the public.
Very good. Thank you. On a lighter note now, we're going to turn our attention to an organization in the Bay Area that's bringing seniors together in community. Bab Freiberg is the executive director of Ashby Village, a vibrant nonprofit that connects elderly people with each other and with the resources needed to stay active, independent, and fulfilled. It was founded in 2010. The community relies on each other and over 300 trained essential service volunteers, program leadership volunteers, screen service providers, and partnerships with regional government aging agencies and coalitions, community groups, and businesses. Bab Freiberg, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's just so important given what we've just heard from Denny Chen of Justice and Aging and Laura Mosqueda of the National Center of Abuse. Yes, Ashby Village is all about helping older adults make decisions about how they want to age and where they age. We're all people that have seen our parents, our friends, our neighbors who've aged alone or without adequate care or supportive friends, and without kind of the opportunities we want to share our wisdom, our talents, our passion. So as you said, we've got over 400 adult members, 300 volunteers who are really rewriting that story and allowing us to age in our communities with vibrancy and purpose, and a close-knit network of people who each of us gives to each other and gains from each other.
And as I understand it, Ashby Village is part of a national movement, the National Village Movement. It's a grassroots movement that coordinates critical services for older adults across the country. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of that movement?
Yes. So there are about 300 villages operating across the country. And there's also something called the Village Movement California, which is a coalition of 45 villages across California that provides training, advocacy, research for villages, as well as the National Village-to-Village Network, which helps around 300 villages across the United States operate and get started.
Can you tell us, so first of all, before I lose that, move on from that point, Ashby Village covers East Bay cities of Albany, Berkeley, El Cerrito, Emeryville, Kensington, Richmond, parts of Oakland. Are there other village organizations in the rest of the Bay Area?
Yes, yes. And right. If somebody goes to the website for Village Movement California, they can find their the village that's closest to them.
Great. We'll put that on our page on KALW.org as well. Go to the Your Call page. So Ashby Village and these other villages uses something called peer-to-peer approach to connect older adults to each other. Tell us a little bit more about that philosophy, please.
Sure. So you can participate in Ashby Village as a member, as a volunteer, or both. We're a reciprocal community. So let's say you have expertise in technology. Well, you can become one of our in-home technology volunteers who helps older adults get on technology and deal with issues of social isolation. This is one of our most in-demand services, especially during COVID, where now making friends and socializing has really been dependent on being online. You could be somebody that loves hikes and walks and provide that for our members. You could be somebody who accompanies me on a doctor's visit because my kids have moved away. And now I don't want to go to those doctor's visits alone. And I need somebody to kind of help translate some of the information. And then at the end of the day, you and I are friends. You might be somebody who, you know, loves to put on events, bring in speakers. You have a background in science. You can help put on programs for older adults. We have over 60 programs that operate each month. Perhaps you're somebody who cares a lot about local issues and state or national civic issues. You can be a part of our Elder Action Committee and advocate for causes that you're really compassionate about.
You know, I hate to make this sound transactional, but in a sense, you could be saying that by becoming involved in this organization, you're kind of paying it forward for the kind of help that you might need later in life.
That's a beautiful example. It's absolutely true. A lot of our volunteers are paying it forward and then later become members. A lot of volunteers try out Ashby Village by volunteering for a while and then decide, I want to join. And the other joy of volunteering is it's based on your passion, your interest. Let's say you have professional skills in marketing or finance or communication, fundraising. We can put those to use. So it's really volunteers get to have a lot of decision making about how they volunteer and what time they give to us. We don't have any requirements on the number of hours or when or days of week. If you love to prepare homes, great. We've got a job for you.
If you've got a question for Bab, or if you have any experience to share about how you've been helped or been able to help other people in your community, especially for aging in place or having a fulfilling life after a certain age, please give us a call. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Bab, I want to ask you a little bit more about, can you share any specific stories from the village and how it's helped members?
Sure. And I was actually thinking about what we heard before. When you said you're turning 65, congratulations.
Thank you.
And that it's complex to understand how to, which Medicare plan to choose. Well, Ashby Village is a great resource for that. We have members who provide that kind of guidance and can work with you to figure out what's the right plan for you. We also heard about elder abuse, and it made me think about all the scam prevention trainings and programs and workshops that we put on. Or talking about finding providers, whether home care providers or, somebody to come repair your roof. We've put together a list of preferred providers that are screened and vetted, and that's both by us, Ashby Village, and by the members themselves. They talk to each other and communicate with each other about, who to go to for what kinds of needs.
That's great. I may be calling on you for advice about Medicare Part B. Oh my God, it's so confusing. Why do you think the community is? Why do you think community among older people is so important as they age?
Yes,
I mean health wise. Besides just supporting each other and the various activities you mentioned, like clean the leaves out of my roof gutters.
Right. Exactly. So there are studies after studies about how social isolation and loneliness worsen older adults' mental and physical health and shorten our lifespans. And we know too well that COVID has exacerbated this. So really, Ashby Village is about social connections, human-to-human contact. So many of our members, they may join for some of our services, but actually they stay because of the people, the friendships that they build, the social life that they create. I had one member tell me yesterday that Ashby Village is a platonic Tinder for older adults. That was pretty funny.
That's great.
So really, the research on, gathering together, being a part of a community that you belong to, that care about you, that call you when you don't show up, makes a difference in our lives.
Mm-hmm. What's the process for someone if they want to become involved, either as a member or as a volunteer?
Or both. They can call us. I can put that, give you that information. They can email us. They can check out our website. We have all different ways. If people, you know, have vision or hearing impairment, we help them with their application. So it's, we are there to serve older adults. So whatever way is most convenient and accessible for people.
I don't know if you heard the earliest part of our hour, but we were talking earlier about Social Security and Medicare. Do you have any thoughts about how the, you know, Republican-controlled House of Representatives, how that might affect social programs for seniors?
Yes. It's a really good question and an extremely important issue. The state of California has something called the Master Plan on Aging, which is looking at how, you know, as described earlier, how poverty and the lack of a safety net impacts older adults. And you know, given the growing demographics of boomers and the boomer plus population, it's a crisis that we are about to enter. And so we are active, the Village Movement is active both nationally and statewide in lobbying for long-term care support insurance for older adults, so that older adults of, you know, middle income older adults can access and have the support and the funding for the long-term care services that they need.
That's wonderful. A caller called in, didn't want to be on the line, but she wanted to just have you clarify that, make sure she understood that Ashby Village encourages, in fact, seniors to age in their own homes, right?
That's correct. That's, we are not a residential community. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're happy to help people find the right residential community, but that's not us. We're really a network of people that give and gain from each other.
Okay. I want to take one more call before we close things out. Judy on line two, welcome to your call.
Thank you. You can hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
I wanted to tell people about a very urgent, imminent threat to traditional Medicare. It's a pilot, so-called pilot program, that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is spinning out. Called ACO REACH. It's an acronym, R-E-A-C-H, ACO. And it's basically a privatization of traditional Medicare. And once it's a, you know, it's a pilot program, so it doesn't need any legislative vetting, you know, or approval. And once it becomes, you know, a pilot program, their goal is to make it 100%. It's basically making Medicare Advantage the same situation where a private insurance company is in between you and your provider and Medicare, coming in for traditional Medicare, which is the basic kind that many people have, where they don't have to. It's complicated, but anyway, I can send a link to you this evening, and maybe you can put it on your website. It's slated to. It was so awful that it was, it's slated to be pulled the end of this year under a different name, and so it's now coming back as ACO REACH.
Judy, I want to thank you. Thank you for that call. Bab Freiberg, do you have any information about that?
Well, that's the exact kind of information that our members and our volunteers communicate to each other through our meetings, through our newsletter, through our presentations. So it's a perfect reason to be a part of our community so you can access that kind of critical information.
You mentioned presentations, and I think we didn't cover that before. I actually do happen to be on your email list, and I see you have lots of speakers from time to time. Can you just give us a brief overview of the kind of speakers you have come to talk to folks?
Sure. Yes, we have over 60 programs happening every month. That includes performances, speakers on topics of interest to our membership, arts and culture events and speakers. We have a series called Science and Ideas, where we bring, you know, provocative and scientists. We're doing the latest research to talk about what they're discovering. We have memoirs of people. We have writers. Last month, we had an in-person concert by an amazing trio. So it's our volunteers and members who make the decisions about what they want and what they want to see and hear and make happen. And we put it on.
That's fantastic. If you wouldn't mind, please give the your website and the website of the California Village. I've got that name wrong, but if you can give us those two websites, and we'll also put them on our page.
Sure. We are Ashby Village, www.ashbyvillage.org. And there you can also sign up for our newsletter, find out more about membership and volunteering. And for the California Village Movement, it's simply www.villagemovementcalifornia.org. And you can find the closest village to you.
Very good. Thank you so much, Bab Freiberg, Executive Director of Ashby Village, for joining us on Your Call. We'll have those links on our page and the links to the other guests that we had earlier and their organizations as well. Today's show was produced by Bee Soul. Thank you, Bee. And engineered by Kevin Vance. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks also to Rose Aguilar for asking me to fill in 2 days this week. It's been a joy. I'm Eric Jansen. Have a great day.